Welcome to another edition of the Volunteer State. I'm Blake Topmeyer with John Adams of the Knoxville News Sentinel. Tennessee football practice is underway. Vols got going last week. First practice on Thursday. And the much anticipated practice debut of Caden Salter is on hold. Caden Salter among the players suspended after a preseason incident at Stokely Hall. And so Salter now is serving an indefinite suspension. So we're going to have to wait on when this four-star freshman quarterback recruit makes his debut this spring. And conceivably, that puts him at the bottom of the quarterback depth chart. John, how much do you think this affects the quarterback competition? Does this just reflect what the depth chart probably would have been anyway? Or does this otherwise take Salter out of the competition, or ultimately does it not matter? Is he going to be fully in the mix of this competition when all is said and done?
I think it matters, but it doesn't have to determine the outcome. Yes, he made a mistake, and it's not a very impressive beginning for someone that you might count on to start as a freshman quarterback, but this can be overcome, certainly. However, when you're trying to get all the reps you can. You're trying to learn a college offense. You're learning about your teammates. You're learning these new coaches. I think in a way, maybe it helps him. It would be more pronounced, perhaps, as disadvantage if the old staff were still here and all these other guys had been through their coaching and knew what their system was, if we ever really did know what Jeremy Pruitt's system for offense was. I guess there was some meaning to it. But with a new coaching staff, everybody's on page one. Everybody's starting out together. And it does put him behind, though, in a transition. So he can make that up, but he doesn't need to make any more mistakes like the one he's made.
Yeah, and so to rehash what happened here, four Tennessee football players, Caden Salter, the most notable among them, but also linebacker Martavius French, linebacker Aaron Willis, who's another four-star early enrollee freshman, and defensive lineman Isaac Washington, were arrested on misdemeanor drug charges after an incident at Stokely Hall. There was a fourth member of the football team suspended, Salter. There was a juvenile arrested in connection with that incident who was not named by police. We know Salter is not yet 18 and is now suspended along with the others, so I guess you can put two and two together there and figure things out with where things stand in this incident. So misdemeanor charges, drug charges, and that's where we stand. It's certainly, to me, it's not the end of the world. Misdemeanor charges, players come back from that all the time, sure. I think what's maybe more concerning, if you're a Tennessee fan, is you want your quarterback, really everybody on your team, but particularly your quarterback, to be making good decisions, both on the field and off the field. And Caden Salter is only 17 years old. I don't think the story of his life has been written yet by any means. But it's not a great first impression when your four-star quarterback is running around with a crew that is now suspended for preseason activities. You want your quarterback to be calm, cool, collected, making good decisions out there, being a team leader, and knowing the magnitude of the position. When you're the quarterback at Tennessee, everything you do is under the microscope. If you are a jerk in class, if you're a jerk to the lunch lady, if you show up 5 minutes late to practice, if you're getting suspended, that's news in Knoxville, Tennessee, and really throughout Tennessee. And that's not what you want out of your quarterback. You want someone who you're trusting to be a leader. And to me, more than the actual incident or more than the charges, that's the concern I would have, if I'm a Tennessee coach or a Tennessee fan, is, is this someone who's making smart decisions? And if it's not, again, that doesn't write the story for his life, but you need to go to work and making sure they start making good decisions.
I think, Blake, it really makes you wonder about his maturity. And I know he's only 17, but if you're going to a major college as a true freshman and you have a chance to compete for the job, you need to be savvy about all that, as you mentioned, every peripheral issue. You are a celebrity, like it or not, and everything you do will be magnified. But if you're going in there with the idea, I want to win the starting job as a freshman, I think I can do that. Well, you've got to have everything in order, your personal life, whatever. I mean, you go back, and I know this is an extraordinary example in Peyton Manning, but he wasn't really supposed to start as a true freshman. Jerry Colquitt was next in line. He would be a senior in 1994. He had competed very hard with Heath Shuler for the job in the past. Talented guy, sharp guy, could have had a very good senior season, but he got injured in the first game. Then things kind of unraveled. There were three guys competing for the starting job, and including baseball player Todd Helton. But Peyton Manning eventually won the job. But it just shows you how ready Peyton Manning was. And I know he's exceptional when it comes to preparation and maybe maturity as well. But that's kind of – I'm not saying you can get a Peyton Manning every year for your quarterback competition, but you need someone toward – headed in that direction, someone with some of those same values and attributes to be your quarterback. Because it's going to be hard to win a quarterback job for anybody. And you got to just take care of business. And remember that this is business.
This makes me wonder whether we were overlooking, maybe not you, maybe I was, maybe other people were. We're overlooking a couple guys in this quarterback competition, because I thought sort of the favorite was Hendon Hooker. And I still think he's the favorite. He's a 15-game career starter. He had some success. He wasn't a standout, but he had some success at Virginia Tech. He's a dual threat. And I think, you know, as a lot of guys, I think he could elevate his game in Josh Heupel's system. And so I think he's the favorite. And then I think a lot of my focus, a lot of people's focus has been on Salter, because he's the new guy. He's the four-star freshman. He's the guy you haven't seen. He looks good on the highlight films. I think we all kind of think he could be a good fit for Heupel's system. And so, you know, my focus has probably inordinately been spent on those two guys, Hooker and Salter. But the other two guys in the middle, I wonder, should we be talking more about? You know, Harrison Bailey is the guy that started the last three games of last season. And I know you, John, you haven't closed the book on Bailey by any means. I believe you've been a little higher on Bailey maybe than I previously was. But then also Brian Maurer. Brian Maurer's a guy that started four games in 2019, slid down the depth chart in 2020, but we know Maurer had some injury situations. He dealt with a hamstring injury in the preseason. Just not sure if he was all right physically last year. And so maybe I wasn't giving, you know, enough credit to that and too quickly overlooking him. Do you think that, you know, someone like Harrison Bailey or Brian Maurer could actually end up atop the heap of this quarterback competition, or am I right in saying that it's Hendon Hooker's job to lose?
Well, admittedly, I haven't seen enough of Hendon Hooker to know just how good he is or project how good he might be in this offense. I have seen Harrison Bailey, and I really liked what I saw of him. I think there's a tendency with all of us, we're in a way, we're all critics. We look at a guy playing, we see what he does wrong. See what he's not capable of doing. Harrison Bailey, to me, he's not a natural runner. He's not a running quarterback. He's not a dual threat quarterback, as I like to say. However, I noticed last season when he needed to run, he did. When he saw opportunities to run, he took those opportunities. A lot of guys that are more of a drop back passer, they shy away from that. You know, they think, well, this isn't what I do, so I'm not going to run here. I'm just going to look for another receiver. I see that opening, but I'm not taking it. That's not who I am. To me, that's Harrison Bailey improvising and showing that he's not afraid to extend his game, extend himself to make a play to help his team. Now, I may be completely overrating that attribute, but it just really struck me in a positive way. And I also liked, I think he's pretty accurate. I think he showed poise. And I guess the longer I follow football and watch quarterbacks, the less enamored I become with arm strength. That was always my big thing. Those were the guys that always turned my head. You know, sure. Going back to when I was a kid, man, look at that throw. John Elway, I like watching him play more than anybody in the NFL. And Aaron Rodgers probably next, because they can flick that ball and it goes out of there like a rocket with seemingly little effort. So that's what turned my head. But the more I watch this sport, I think more in terms of quick decision making and accuracy.
I think that's such a good point, John, because that is, I will admit, that is one reason why I probably don't give Harrison Bailey more of a full chance to be the quarterback of the future for Tennessee, because I see that arm strength and I've heard the questions, and I think they're fair questions about Harrison Bailey's arm strength. And whether it's, I mean, it's not like the guy has a noodle arm, don't get me wrong. I don't think it's, I think he belongs on an SEC roster. That's not the issue, but he doesn't have that head turning arm strength that makes you just go, wow, this guy can sling it. But I think you're right. And I think Tennessee's quarterbacks coach, Joey Halsley, made a good comment about that, or a relevant comment in the preseason. He wasn't talking about Bailey in particular, but a reporter asked Halsley to handicap the importance of three different things. You know, I can't remember exactly what they are, accuracy, decision making, or understanding the offense, or poise, or something to that effect, and arm strength. And Halsley said arm strength would rank last for him. And not to say that's not important, but it just doesn't rank as high as the other three. You got to know the offense, know where to go with the ball, direct the team. You got to be accurate. I mean, if you whistle at 100 miles an hour, but you're not accurate, that doesn't help anybody. And so arm strength goes last. And I think there's something to that. Again, we're not talking about a guy with a terrible arm, and I just don't think he has an elite arm in terms of strength. But I'm probably not giving enough credit to the fact that Harrison Bailey, as a true freshman last year, in a season in which his preseason was derailed by quarantine, completed over 70% of his passes. I mean, that's pretty dang good. Had four touchdowns, two interceptions. I thought, like you said, John, he showed a willingness to get out of the pocket when danger closed in. You know, against Vanderbilt, he completed almost 80% of his passes for over 200 yards. So, you know, we're ignoring the fact that Harrison Bailey was pretty accurate, pretty poised, and didn't look all that bad as a true freshman.
There are times when arm strength comes into play, and we saw that this past season with Stetson Bennett, Georgia's quarterback, the former walk-on, the transfer who comes in there, and who admittedly has his arm isn't as strong as Harrison Bailey's. He had a weak arm. He couldn't stretch the field. He couldn't make throws that really got George Pickens, one of the best players in the SEC, certainly one of the top receivers, couldn't get him involved with the offense because he couldn't throw that ball really deep enough to create those one-on-one opportunities for Pickens to capitalize on. So he was very limited, and you saw the offense perk up when JT Daniels, who was injured early, the Southern Cal transfer, came in and played. And honestly, he doesn't have a rocket arm either. It's better than Stetson Bennett, so it looks dramatically better. But when you think about the really strong arm, the guy that can make that throw across the field on a line and get there before the DB does, I think that's my idea, that deep out, that line drive throw. However, sometimes guys with that strong arm, they overestimate their arm strength. So there's even a downside to that with a strong arm, where you're so confident in your throwing ability, you try to put it between two defenders, you make that throw across your body that we're all told you don't do that. But a few guys in the world, Elway, Rodgers, can get away with it, but not many of them can.
Changing gears, I wrote a story this week, John, about the difference in this staff. They say, you know, one of the differences between this staff and Jeremy Pruitt, I think there's going to be a lot of differences, but one, Jeremy Pruitt almost proudly moved guys around from position to position. You know, he said, if we get short on depth in October, November, and we got to move guys around, I don't want this to be the first time these guys are having to play these positions. So we're going to use some time in the spring to prepare some of our reserves to play multiple spots. And you saw some guys like an Aaron Beasley played three different positions while Pruitt was here. He was a safety, then he was a running back, then he was a linebacker. You know, there's some other guys I couldn't even keep track of what position they were playing on a given week. And some guys, you know, flip from one position back to another, back to the position they were at before. I just thought it really stunted the ability for certain reserves to develop. And at least the early feedback from Heupel and his staff, his offensive coordinator, Alex Golish, have said they don't really want to do that. They don't want to, you know, move guys around a lot. And that's not to say they might switch some of these positions of the guys they have inherited, but they haven't done that yet. And I think most notably, Dee Beckwith, he finished last season at running back. Pruitt started him off as wide receiver slash tight end. And of course, you got to move a guy around at least once. And so he moved him to running back. That's where he finished the season, got a couple carries toward the end of the year. And at 6'5", 230 pounds, he doesn't necessarily profile as your physical body type that you expect in a running back. But so I thought Heupel might move him right off the bat in the spring. But they said, no, we're going to leave him there and see what happens, see if he can develop into something there. What do you think of this? I mean, I'm sure I'm making a bigger deal than it needs to be, John. I think you can probably find success stories both ways of guys that flourished after coaches moved them around to a few spots, and then other guys that maybe had their development stunted because practice to practice, they didn't even know where they were going to be on the field. But what do you make of it, and what do you make particularly of Heupel's decision to keep Dee Beckwith at running back and see where that goes?
Well, I think like most things, you get into trouble when you deal in extremes. So I think, yes, sometimes you need to shift a guy. A guy's not developing the way you think, but you see athleticism, you see potential. Maybe you need to be creative and find a spot for him, a different spot. But you can't overdo it. And I think that might be, you mentioned that Pruitt did it proudly. You're exactly right about that. And I think it had a lot to do with his high school background. He coached high school ball in Alabama, and you need to do that. When you're coaching high school ball, you're not sure what these guys are just developing as football players. You don't know what you can do. They can do best. You have limited depth. I mean, if your star running back gets hurt, you don't really have a backup. You might need to take one of your linebackers or your safety and put him at running back in high school. So I think that's very advantageous. I think that's a great quality for a high school coach. Not so much for a college coach. I think it can be beneficial, like I said, when used in modest proportions, but not to the extent that he did. And you mentioned Dee Beckwith. I think it's interesting that size you think of as a strength in sports. You want somebody big, fast, and strong. That usually equals success. And yet he's discriminated against as a running back. And some of football's greatest running backs have not fit those dimensions that we like. It seems as though we've become more and more specialized in exactly. It's as though the running back needs to be 5'10 or 5'11, 217 pounds. A compact running back, low center of gravity, can make those quick cuts, has good footwork. But you look back through the years, I mean, Jim Brown, who some still say is the greatest running back of all time, I think Jim Brown was about 6'2", 230, an oversized running back. We've seen other guys, the best running back in the NFL is Derrick Henry. He's 6'3", looks like he weighs about 250, but he runs like an antelope, so it doesn't matter. So I'm glad they're giving him a chance to be a running back. And we talked about some that's off air the other day. We talked about it. And, you know, you said, well, what about just putting him in a shotgun formation, mm-hmm. take a direct snap? You know, since I've been at this so long, I can remember where that big, strong running back was more of the prototype. When you go back into the to the early 70s and you ran that I formation, you get about guy 7 or 8 yards behind center, just hand him the ball and let him get. He doesn't need to make quick cuts so much. Just find a hole and use speed and power and get through the line. So I think there's a place for that. And I wonder if coaches have missed the boat through the years because they wouldn't consider guys a running back because he didn't fit that particular box that you need. Not everybody can be an Emmitt Smith. Barry Sanders was even smaller when you think about it, but he was compact. So I'm glad they're doing that with D. Beckwith, and he may well end up at another position. And I would hate to think his size is such a disadvantage. You mentioned what these coaches have talked about doing with this, and the offensive coordinator did this at length in an interview. Talked about, you know, you don't want to discriminate because of a guy's how he's built or, you know, his. Don't profile him as not fitting this. Let's give him a chance and let's see where this goes.
Yeah. How many times in life, John, has a grown man said, if only I was 3 inches shorter, you know, it's almost like the situation D. Beck was in. It's like, if only I was 3 inches shorter, I could be a running back. Like, I don't know many scenarios in life where a grown man is just sitting there thinking like, boy, I wish I could be just a few inches shorter.
Or not
be able to ride that roller coaster, you know?
Not even a grunt, not just grown men or teenagers. You know, a 17-year-old high school junior or senior saying, gosh, I'm glad I'm so stocky.
Yeah. What I need to do is shrink a few more inches.
Well, we'll see where it goes, but I'm kind of intrigued by that. And I do remember Cordell Patterson, a wide receiver, Tennessee used a lot on end of rounds, and he's been a kickoff return guy in the NFL, excelled at that. He's got great speed. He's a sprinter, but he happens to be, I think, 6'4". And I thought Derek Dooley, I thought in games he should have put him back there in the Wildcat package and just centered it to him and let him try to run over or outrun somebody.
John, would it surprise you to know that on one of the podcast apps, we're up to 49 ratings for this podcast and have a 4.5-star ranking? Does that surprise you to know that?
You need to put that in context. No, I don't. A 49. I mean, I don't know what 49 means.
Now, 49 people have issued a rating to this podcast.
Oh, okay. I thought that was like a score.
But we'll call it 49 out of 50, but I'd like us to get to 50 ratings, if not more, for this podcast. So I'm hoping that you could be lucky number 50 in reviewing this podcast and maybe give us a little boost beyond that 4.5-star average ranking. Maybe give us that 5 stars as the 50th person ranking. And maybe John Adams will send you a little prize pack through the mail. I doubt he will, but maybe you get a signed copy of John's first book, Carry On Like You Live, or his sequel, Keep Carrying On, right?
Yeah, I'm glad you remember titles. I mean, yeah, those are exactly right. Yes, I'll bring it to the door, sign it, and take your $20 and go on my way.
So the book is not free, but the signature will be. John, let's close. Getting back to the football topic that previously was at hand here, but it's obviously too early to make any real assessments of this new coaching staff, this new era. But we've now heard from Josh Heupel again after his first spring practice availability. We've heard from Tennessee coordinators. We've gotten to know this staff maybe really a little bit more than we ever got to know certain members of Jeremy Pruitt's staff. They were shielded from the media like we were, you know, some evil enemy that was just going to take him down. Maybe that's true. Maybe we are. But what's your impression, John, as you get to know this staff a little bit more and get to know Heupel a little bit more, and not just your impression of him, but whether he can succeed here? Because I've seen just in his interviews and in his poise, someone that I feel like has grown since the time that I previously knew him as a coordinator at Missouri. It seems like he's someone that's come into his own a little bit as a leader, as a head of the organization type guy. Now, I don't know how much, you know, how you conduct yourself with the press really matters in wins and losses, but it does give you a little glimpse into someone's personality and you know, their way of doing business. What's your takeaway here in about 2 months into the Josh Heupel era? How's he doing? And is this a guy that you think can have success with his staff here at Tennessee?
I tell you what, I really don't know if he can have success, because we've got a long track record here where coaches have failed. And I thought some of them would be successful. So at this point, I just don't know, and it sometimes doesn't matter how articulate someone is, how poised they are in media interviews, or where they're just a disaster in interviews. I mean, what's going to make a successful coach? I don't think we see evidence of that. We can just, because it's kind of our job, and you got to write and talk about something. So I think you tend to amplify things that might not really be that significant. But I think the fact that you knew him as an offensive coordinator at Missouri, and you can apply that to what he's become as a head coach, I mean, I think that's can be insightful. He's had the experience of 3 years at Central Florida, Jeremy, as a head coach. Jeremy Pruitt had none. Butch Jones had been head coach at two other programs, Central Michigan and Cincinnati, before he came here. So it's hard to say, but I think it is interesting. Not that this will impact his one loss record. He doesn't seem, more and more coaches want less and less access. Mm-hmm. I think that's a general theme in college football. It's gotten more so that way the longer I've been in this in the SEC. The Big Ten might have even been ahead of the SEC in that regard at one time. They don't want to deal with that. They don't want players dealing with it. They don't see anything good that comes of that. And also this idea, and a lot of this emanates from Nick Saban and his success. Nick Saban's rarely do his assistant coaches meet with the media. And in turn, rarely does the general public get to know much about these guys. Saban's explanation for that, I'm sure, is that we want one message, one consistent message. I can see that. But I doubt seriously that many coaches that work for Nick Saban are going to go rogue just because they have a microphone in front of them and can talk to the media. So I think it's interesting that Heupel doesn't seem that concerned about whether it's offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, or a position coach talks to the media. I mean, from our standpoint, I like that.
Yeah, to me, if you only allow one voice, it makes you seem like a control freak, I think. It means you don't trust the people that you've hired to six-figure or seven-figure salaries to talk for 15 minutes and not sound like a complete idiot. And so if you don't have that trust, then I think that's a failure on you as a CEO. But that's Nick Saban's way of doing things, and Nick Saban is the most successful coach of the land, so he can tell me to take that opinion and shove it, Mr. Topmeyer. And you know, I like, John, that you were trying to give me a little credit for maybe sensing some growth and development from Josh Heupel, where he was as an offensive coordinator to where he is as a coach. But really where you started there was that we're just sort of overanalyzing and speculating wildly about the minutia of spring practice. And I really think that's probably more the reality of the situation, is that we're speculating and analyzing minutia, because it's late March, early April. Spring practice is going on, and no real opponent will line up across from Tennessee for several months still. So this is where we are, but it's better than this time last year when there was no practice, no sports, and we were all very, very sad. But on that happy note, we're going to leave it there until next time, John. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Volunteer State.